This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, opening day for Major League Baseball is tomorrow, and some new rules are in place for the season. We'll talk to a baseball statistician about what's changed and how it affects the game. Now, Tuesday's state Supreme Court election between conservative-backed candidate Daniel Kelly and liberal-backed candidate Janet Protasiewicz is the most expensive race of its type in U.S. history. Gained that title last month, according to the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, the candidates have raised a combined $39 million. Ads backing Protasiewicz dominated the field for a few weeks, but now pro-Kelly ads have apparently taken the lead. Outside from groups from around the country are also getting involved in the race, which could swing the ideological balance of the court in favor of liberals for the first time since 2008. We're talking about the money and the messaging in the final days before the election. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you feel about the amount of money and out-of-state attention that the race is getting? It's an officially nonpartisan race. Does it feel nonpartisan to you, or do you treat it like any other partisan election? Are you seeing ads on TV, on streaming, online? Are they negative, missing the mark on the issues you care about? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Christina LaPlante is an assistant professor of political science and public administration at UW La Crosse. Christina, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
All right. Big, expensive state Supreme Court race. Can you give us the basics on what is bringing so much cash into this campaign?
Well, yeah, my goodness, as you had just noted, as of last month, right, just shy of $40 million, becoming the most expensive court race in United States history. And that's all for a good reason. I think that there's three big takeaways here about why this race is attracting so much attention. So first, obviously, we got to talk about the balance of power. The winner of this race is going to determine the ideological composition of the court, which currently has a 4-3 conservative majority, and Protasiewicz, which could very much be the changing factor there. As you noted, having a liberal majority for the first time since 2008. Of course, on the other hand, we've got the issue of abortion. The overturning of Roe versus Wade apparently remains a central policy focus for Democrats, especially with the 1849 Wisconsin law that makes it a felony to provide abortions. And, you know, with what we've got Josh Call, the attorney general, doing, we very much should expect to see some type of abortion case before the Wisconsin Supreme Court. So you've got a lot of energy and a lot of enthusiasm there. You've got gerrymandering, right? What are we going to do about the gerrymandered maps in the state of Wisconsin? And then you've got national implications, which I think is why you're seeing so much outside spending, you know, large individual donors from other states, national policy organizations. You know, don't forget that in 2020, it was the Wisconsin Supreme Court that narrowly voted just by 4-3 to block an attempt by Trump allies to throw out a couple hundred thousand ballots in those liberal-leaning counties. So there is a lot of work for the Supreme Court to do, and I feel like I'm just kind of skimming the surface of why this race is getting so much attention.
Right, and on a dollar-per-vote ratio, this is going to be really high. These are spring elections, traditionally not high turnout. The primary had about 20%, which doesn't sound high, but by Supreme Court spring election standards, really pretty high compared to, you know, even some final Supreme Court elections in the state. That said, it isn't going to look like turnout for a presidential or a Senate or governor election. What do you see when it comes to money versus turnout in this race?
Well, yeah, 20% certainly does sound small, but in the context of how these elections normally go, I think on average it's been, you know, anywhere from 10 to 15% turnout over the last decade or so, just talking about kind of, you know, Wisconsin special elections, especially court elections. But, you know, that's nothing to blush about, this 20%. Moreover, you know, like you said, we've got high turnout, you know, about 60% for our presidential elections, 40% for midterms, and then all of our special elections, you know, you're really lucky to get a fifth of voters turning out there. But not only are we seeing turnout consistently increasing, but who is increasing is equally important. You know, there's a reason that majority of these ads are airing on Facebook. and Instagram, they, you know, especially the Pro Tsayawitz campaign, right? They want to hit that younger Gen Z voter. They want them to see these advertisements and they want them to turn out. And I fully expect turnout to be on par, if not higher, on April 4th.
Now, one thing that makes it hard in the journalism world to talk about these elections is they're nonpartisan elections, so there's this sort of elaborate facade of a nonpartisan election, and yet one candidate is nonpartisan, but all the Democratic funding goes to them, and another candidate's nonpartisan, and all the Republican funding, and I'm talking parties and groups, special interest groups and so on, goes to that candidate. Can you talk about the sort of air quotes we could throw around nonpartisan here?
Yeah, it certainly doesn't feel like a nonpartisan contest, does it? And I think I just read not too long ago that the Democratic Party of Wisconsin is officially Pro Tsayawitz's largest donor. So, and moreover, when we look at the types of policy organizations, you know, pro-choice versus pro-life, many of those organizations are throwing money at their respective candidates on either side of this line. So I think we have to really sit and think about you know, the purpose of a nonpartisan contest, what role the judiciary plays in our government and our institutions. And we seem to be very clearly deviating from that. I don't think you could find a single Wisconsin voter who would agree with the fact that, yeah, this very much seems like a nonpartisan contest to me.
Talking to Christina Plant, Assistant Professor of Political Science at UW-La Crosse, looking at big, big money in Wisconsin's state Supreme Court race, breaking a national record for state Supreme Court races. Let's go to your calls now at 800-642-1234. Jed is with us in Lacouture. Jed, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to bring up?
Oh, just a few things. I'm just kind of bummed out with the larger system, not only the specific election, either for Supreme Court in Wisconsin or the recent Senate race in Georgia. It's like, seems like you got to pay to play so that people are buying elections, they're buying politicians, they're buying policy. And it just seems like a lose-lose situation to me. And it's not the lesser of two losers or the lesser of two evils. It's still a loser and it's still evil. It's like putting gas in a broken car. It's just a bummer. It's not merit-based. Perhaps we should have an electoral system and no money at all.
Jed, thanks a lot for the call. Christina, I think Jed, not alone, feeling disillusioned with the amount of money that goes into politics, and him saying you got to pay to play in the political game.
Yeah, and what an exceptionally frustrating sentiment to feel about one's own democracy, and certainly shared with millions of Americans. And races didn't always used to be like this, especially nonpartisan races. It wasn't until 2008 and the Citizens United court case ruling, where now, as long as outside groups aren't directly coordinating with campaigns, they can basically spend unlimited amounts of money, you know, for influencing elections, right? There's no other way around that. That's what they're doing. And absolutely, right? How do we get out of this? How do we get out of this hole? You know, we need real campaign finance reform. You know, that's really the only way that we can start rebuilding the reputation and legitimacy of our political institutions. And you know, not falling victim to this belief that very, you know, frequently accurate belief that our politicians are bought.
Thanks a lot for that call, Jed, at 800-642-1234. Nate joins us now in Milwaukee. Nate, hello.
Hi, thanks for having me. The big concern I have is that the gerrymandering means we don't have a legislature that represents us. And as a citizen, one of the things we go to the legal system for is to protect our rights. And part of those rights is to have legislature that represents us. So anybody that says this should be discussed in the legislature, well, we need to actually have a legislature that works for that to happen. Something that a previous caller mentioned about money in politics sparked a memory, in that Wisconsin used to have public funding for elections. So that's something that we could actually potentially return to help deal with this problem. And a small thing that hasn't made any of the press so far is the Milwaukee Bar Association did its qualified, not qualified recommendations for anybody running for judge statewide or in this area. A lot more of them actually ended up saying Kelly was not qualified than Protasewicz. So I thought that was and these are people who have voted qualified for people that were appointed by Republicans. So I think that's actually a little less partisan thing to go by.
Nate, thanks a lot for the call. To Nate's first point, Christina, you mentioned redistricting, the way our political lines are drawn in Wisconsin. This has come up a lot as a likely case that could end up coming before the state Supreme Court over the next year or two. How have you heard that talked about in the race?
Well, yeah, first of all, a lot of excellent points brought up just then. But I think what all of these really excellent questions and comments are getting at is that there is severe disillusionment in this country about any branch of government's ability to be impartial, any ability to write and pass and execute laws in a way that benefits society as a whole, rather than just some specific narrow partisan agenda. So obviously in the state of Wisconsin, we look to the state legislature to redraw these district boundaries. However, we, you know, perceive that through a partisan lens. There is the gerrymandering problem. Well, let's look to the courts to fix that. Well, now, you know, even though we ought to have these nonpartisan races, which they're very clearly not partisan, even our courts, right, the one institution supposed to be impartial, is also falling victim to this partisan problem. I think what I hope a lot of people kind of take away from this who are feeling this way is recognizing that there are options and that change is possible. There's other states that are doing things in different ways that help kind of remove this partisan shadow from democratic processes. You know, maybe some movement or momentum for independent commissions. I think California, a handful of other states have independent commissions where they're responsible for redrawing these district lines. So if we can't trust politicians to do their job in an unbiased fashion, maybe we should start considering taking away some of those responsibilities.
Thanks for that call, Nate. We're talking to UW La Crosse political science professor Christina LaPlante about the money going into the race for the state Supreme Court and the issues the two candidates are focusing on in their ads. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you seeing a lot of ads on social media, on streaming, on broadcast TV, on the radio, you name it? What do you think? Does it leave you feeling motivated, burnt out? Do you think we need to change the rules after all this money goes into this one state Supreme Court seat race? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. We're picking up our talk with Christina LaPlante, assistant professor of political science at UW La Crosse. We're looking at the record-setting amount of money that's gone into the race for an open seat on our state Supreme Court, what the campaigns are doing with that money in their ads on TV and social media. Still time for you to join in with your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Christina, let's talk about the messaging now. Let's start with the Kelly campaign and groups backing him. What are you seeing when it comes to the messaging on that side of the race?
One thing that has really stood out to me is the co-opting of Trump-style messaging that we're seeing coming from the Kelly campaign. You know, Trump loves his nicknames, Ron D. Sanctimonious, Sleepy Joe Biden. I love the No Jail Janet that the Kelly campaign has been using to refer to Protasewicz, really using a lot of, in my opinion, some Willie Horton style advertising from the 88 contest between Bush and Dukakis, where during Dukakis's time as Massachusetts governor, he had this furlough program for inmates and, you know, this notorious case of Willie Horton, who committed several crimes while on furlough. It's eerily similar. Like, go watch that advertisement. Watch the Willie Horton advertisement and compare it to some of these No Jail Janet advertisements from the Kelly campaign. They are eerily similar, but this idea of, you know, Democrats are too soft on crime. They don't have what it takes to make the tough decisions to, you know, lead or act effectively. I think that's one of the biggest things that I'm seeing that probably has the greatest potential to resonate with potential voters on a variety of levels.
Now, the soft on crime ads in Wisconsin's state Supreme Court are pretty common. One thing that the state Supreme Court really doesn't do is hear criminal trials directly. Like, they might get an obscure technicality that percolates up from the court. Basically, if you're arrested in Wisconsin, you're probably not going to end up before the state Supreme Court. So it's interesting that keeps getting focused on so much year after year in these races.
Of course, and maybe we're hearing about the constitutionality of some type of tough-on-crime law that mm-hmm. might go before the Supreme Court. But by and large, you're right. I mean, criminal cases often aren't heard at the Supreme Court. And that's just further evidence that voters should be picking up on, that we have very much deviated from a nonpartisan contest in both camps. I think both candidates are guilty of this, of playing on to, you know, very political stereotypes about liberalism and conservatism that are really just being used as part of this numbers game. What's the scariest, biggest message I can deliver to voters to make sure that they're turning out on April 4th?
And then the same question, the Protasiewicz campaign itself and supporters, what are the main lines of messaging there?
I would say the biggest one has to be abortion access. I think you have Democratic strategists who saw how wildly successful that messaging was in the 2022 midterms, how there was not this red wave of Republicans taking Congress. And I think Democrats attributed a lot of that to mobilization and energy and enthusiasm about, well, kind of negatively, right, about the Dobbs decision. And this is what happens when we don't participate in politics, right? We've got to get out there. We've got to fight for our rights. And out of all of the advertisements that I have seen, besides the rather silly advertisement from Protasiewicz about how to pronounce her name, which reminded me a lot of the Lisa Murkowski advertisement when she was a write-in candidate, besides that, it overwhelmingly seems to me fear-based messages from the Protasiewicz campaign about what's going to happen to women's rights and their ability to choose if she's not elected.
Let's go back to our callers with Mary on the line in Milwaukee. Mary, hello.
Hi there. So I'm thinking that I don't like any of the ads at all from either candidate, partly because it's such an assault. If you watch the morning news on any channel, it's like one string pulling abusive commercial after another. They're terribly manipulative. And although I'm pro-choice, my other point is I feel like Judge Protasiewicz is not doing anything beyond demonstrating that she is in favor of protecting the rights of childbearing age women. And as far as I can tell from the ads, it's white women at that. I mean, I'm not hearing any desire to reach out beyond the choir.
Mary, thanks a lot for the call. A couple of big points there, Christina, the like incessant negative stream of ads out there that Mary's seeing can bring a person down, maybe another way to disillusion people about politics.
Yeah, there's absolutely a tipping point when it comes to how negative can a campaign be before it starts demobilizing voters. I think one thing that's happening now is that with all of the contention and the polarization and I think one of the central things happening right now in American politics is this concept of morality politics. In other words, there's a right way to live and there's a wrong way to live. And we're very much developing this conservative morality policy and this liberal morality policy that liberals have a correct way of living. And that is the absolute opposite of what a conservative perceives to be the right way of living. And with that kind of social undercurrent, I think that empowers candidates more to go negative, to take the fear message, to take the anger message, because they can kind of get away with it a little bit more. And more to the point of who do you see represented in these advertisements? Again, you put these two cues together and you know exactly who's being marketed to, right? I think it's overwhelmingly for Democrats, the youth vote, wanting to scare Gen Z and younger voters and maybe even millennials into participating. You will lose your rights if you do not participate. And then conservatives, on the other hand, taking the classic crime frame that if we have a government run by liberals, we'll just have criminals running in the street.
Time for one more caller. Leo is with us in Milwaukee. Leo, hello.
Hey. I first got the vote in 1970, at which time there was only three networks, of course, and there were very few political ads, and they generally focused on issues. Today, I have to say my opinion of the political process is the great spinning mud machine. You take items out of context that look bad, spin it around, make it look as bad as possible, and throw it on the air. As far as the Supreme Court race goes, I have seen exactly one positive ad. Wow. That's not slinging mud at the other side, and it was a Protasiewicz ad.
Leo, thanks for the call. Christina, a great spinning mud machine.
I am definitely going to start using that terminology in my campaigns and elections course. I hope that's okay. I love that phrase. But I think that this all just boils down to the fact that we've kind of lost touch with, I think politicians have really lost touch and how they can effectively communicate with voters. And there's really far less emphasis on issues these days. And it really is all about that emotional appeal. And despite, decades of public opinion survey where people say election year after election year, I hate it. I hate how negative these campaigns are. I can't stand the advertising. But it doesn't change. Politicians still spend, or candidates rather, overwhelming percentages of their budget go just to advertisements. And they're exactly that emotional disposition that we all agree we dislike. But why do they keep doing it? Unfortunately, the answer is they work.
Thanks for that call. And Christina, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Always a pleasure. Thanks so much.
That's Christina LaPlante, Assistant Professor of Political Science and Public Administration at UW-La Crosse. She is with us to talk about the final days of campaigning in the race for state Supreme Court. That race has brought in almost $40 million to the candidates, making it the most expensive state Supreme Court race in U.S. history. Hey, related note coming up here on Central Time to talk about some of the disillusionment and polarization. Guest makes the case that we have had a great pulling apart, she calls it, in the United States. But she says it can be fixed. That's tomorrow on Central Time. Hey, let's hop in our DeLorean cars, eat some Limeade Oreos, and raise a glass of new Coke to celebrate the great failures of recent product design. The Museum of Failure is a traveling exhibit started in Sweden about 6 years ago, and it's back in the United States. Now, it's in New York City for an extended stay, but if you don't have a visit planned, that's okay. You can see a lot of the exhibit at museumoffailure.com. The museum features products that swung and missed, that tried something new that didn't pan out so good. But the goal is not to make fun of the product or their creators, but to celebrate the role of failure as part of innovation and creativity. So New Coke didn't catch on, but the Coca-Cola company's still there, last I checked. Oreo has released some new flavors that caught on a lot better than Limeade. And the DeLorean car, it was in the Back to the Future movies, so that's cool. Celebrating failure, this is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, organ transplants save a lot of lives, but there are concerns that the system doesn't work as well as it should. Find out about a major overhaul that could be in the works for the organ donation system. Now, Major League Baseball's opening day is tomorrow. When the Milwaukee Brewers start their season at Wrigley Field against the Chicago Cubs, you'll notice some new rules in place that are changing the way the sport is played at the highest level. Throughout spring training, pitchers have started getting used to a pitch clock that limits how much time they can wait before they throw the ball. Batters have their own clock, too, before they have to be ready for the pitch. The league is also restricting how much managers can strategically shift their infielders, and they made the bases a few inches bigger. These and other new rule changes are intended to speed up the game and make it more entertaining. So do they? John Keel is co-creator of Numbers Game, a Madison-based business that supplies scorebooks to baseball fans. I talked to him earlier today. before we get into particular changes, I understand one of the big goals was to make baseball games less long, to bring them back to their old length. From what we've seen in preseason, is that happening?
Yeah, the pitch clock, it makes games shorter. There's no question about it. What we've seen in spring training is that games are about 25 minutes less than the average regular season time last year. So pitch clocks are speeding up the game.
And how do those pitch clocks work for people who haven't been watching preseason?
Yeah, so this is the first time that baseball has introduced an official timer into the game, which is very significant. And the way it works is that between pitches, when the bases are empty, pitchers have 15 seconds from the time they receive the ball back from the catcher to start their delivery to home. And batters have to be ready and facing the pitcher with 8 seconds left on that clock, or they can be assessed a strike automatically. When there's runners on base, pitchers get an extra 5 seconds, so they have 20 seconds on the pitch clock when they've got runners on base.
How are players reacting to that? Does it seem like they're in the groove and doing this, or was there a lot of weirdness as this was implemented?
It seems that there is some weirdness. It seems that there's some gamesmanship. Just the other day, there was a pitcher from the New York Yankees that was, he actually recorded an out that was then negated because the umpire said he didn't deliver the pitch in time. So then on his next pitch, he took this long, herky-jerky, exaggerated windup almost to taunt the umpire for basically following the rules and calling a ball on him. So you're seeing a little bit of that. You're seeing pitchers trying to quick pitch. So just before the batter turns their head to look at the pitcher and be ready, the pitcher's already in their motion, ready to try to sneak a ball past. You've seen batters called out to end a game for not being ready. So definitely spring training was an opportunity for players to figure this out. And of course, for fans to get up in arms about the change, because that's what fans do, right?
Now, not just fans. Earlier this month, Milwaukee Brewers pitcher Corbin Burnes expressed his frustration, not with the clock rule itself, but how the league implemented and communicated the changes. Here's a listen.
The umpires are still out there trying to learn the rules as they go. So, the thought coming in is that everything was finalized and we had a month to kind of figure everything out. And as we're going, there's still things that are changing, that's got to stop. That's got to be something that we have something finalized. So these last 2 weeks, we can get comfortable with them.
So that was a couple weeks ago. There have been a couple more weeks to get the wrinkles ironed out. Does it seem like spring training and the preseason was enough time to get this into place?
Well, what we have heard from Major League Baseball is that they haven't seen anything that's making them want to change the rules going into the season. They want to see it play out. So they must feel, from what they've seen on the field, that things are good enough to play when games start counting for real.
All right, a couple more changes. The pitch clock was one of the big ones. Also, this infield shift. Now, for people who got bored and left baseball years ago, remind us how big the infield shift has gotten and why.
Well, baseball is the analytic sport to be all end all. And teams started to figure out a handful of years back just how effective it was to dramatically change the way they position infielders, especially in order to take away the open spots on the field where players commonly hit the ball. They knew that this hitter would most likely hit the ball in this spot, so they put fielders there. And what we saw is that batting averages in Major League Baseball went to their lowest levels basically ever. And what the league has decided to do is, hey, the shift is too effective. The imbalance between offense and defense in this case is too great. We need to bring some action back in the game. And so they've created a rule now where you can only have two players on either side of second base in the infield, basically opening up back holes where batters like to hit the ball. And hopefully the idea here is that it will introduce action back into the game that used to be there before shifts became so dominant.
Is that paying off so far?
The word is that it is. Even locally here with the Brewers, Christian Yelich is a player that people really believed was impacted by the shift. Where he happened to hit a lot of ground balls between that first and second base hole or up the middle, suddenly there were players just standing there waiting for the ball. And his average has been up in the spring, and fans are hoping that's a sign of good things to come as the season goes. And he's been slumping for a couple of years, and the shift is to blame in the minds of some fans for that. So we'll see what happens with him and with similar players around the league.
And finally, the bases themselves, Major League Baseball has embiggened the physical bases. Why?
Well, so the shift ban and the bigger bases are really intended to accomplish something opposite of the pitch clock. Whereas the pitch clock brings something to the game that's never been there before, Major League Baseball is trying to address this problem of games being too long or seeming too long, but also having the least amount of action that they've ever had. The fewest number of balls in play, the fewest number of base runners, and the fewest number of stolen bases. By bringing the bases closer together, by making them bigger, they are tempting teams to take that risk of the stolen base to advance a runner much more than ever. Those are bang-bang plays. They're close plays as it is. So moving a base 4 inches closer is begging players to make that attempt. And we've heard some analysts say that they expect stolen base numbers to double this season over last. And I would say in most cases, fans, the league would be really happy if they saw that kind of action happening on the base paths.
Yeah, me, John, I don't like the big plays in baseball, the strikeout and the home run. They're plays where nobody can do anything about them for the most part.
Right.
I like the stolen bases. I like rundowns and double plays and cool things like that. Am I going to see more of these if I watch the 2023 season?
Rob, I'm with you. I hope to see the same. I'm a guy who likes to keep score at games, and we at Numbers Game, we support people who like to keep score at games, and it gets a little boring just writing K, you know. So now you've got, you know, hopefully you've got more singles and doubles getting guys on base because they've got more holes with the shift ban. And then when they get on base, and by the way, pitchers can't throw over to first base as much as they used to. There's limits on that now too. So, you know, more players moving around the bases, more happening on more pitches. The bet is that this will bring people, as you said, who maybe got bored of baseball or turned away over the last few years, back to the game and seeing a more interesting game.
John, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, it's been great to talk to you.
John Keel is the co-creator of Numbers Game, a Madison-based business that supplies scorebooks to baseball fans. He was with us for an update on new rules in Major League Baseball ahead of opening day tomorrow. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about two friends who served in the Vietnam War together.
James Blankenheim and Everett Wood are friends with a shared experience of military service during the Vietnam War. They speak of the excitement of forging one's path in life, the realities of combat, and the struggles of integration after returning home. Blankenheim and Wood shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices initiative. As a warning, parts of the story describe battleground violence.
My name is Jim Blankenheim, 71 years old, and I'm in Madison, Wisconsin. And my partner here is a corpsman that was with me in Vietnam.
My name's Everett T. Wood, and my age is 73. And I'm in Vincennes, Indiana. The relationship to Jim is, he was a forward observer with us and called in artillery, airstrikes, and tried to help us out during the bad times when we needed help. So how did you get involved? Did you get drafted?
No, I enlisted. My father, when I turned 18, made the comment that he thought I'd never amount to shit. And I said, I'll show you. And not only would I join the military, but I would join the toughest branch they had. That's how I got in the Marine Corps. And also, I felt I needed to do my duty anyway. It's run through our family. So how about you, Doc?
Well, I got off high school. I didn't know what I wanted to do in life. My parents didn't have very much money. You know, I didn't want them to help me through school. You know, I just wanted to be on my own and try to find my own direction, I guess. So I joined the Navy. So remember Hill 1192?
Oh, yeah. That was probably the bloodiest battle we saw.
That was the worst I've ever gone through.
There was like 80 of us walked up in the mountains on what they said was going to be a three-day patrol. What was it, 15 days later we got out of there?
15 guys died up on that hill.
We had no place to put the bodies or the wounded, so they all laid right in the middle of our mini our mini perimeter, and Milligan was there. He got shot in the chest and shot in the leg.
Right. I patched him up.
He lasted 4 days before we could medevac him out. And when he went out, I thought he was dead. I thought he'd never make it. We went to that reunion in Ohio, and he showed up there, and I went, you got to be kidding me. You're alive?
I know.
Because I didn't think he made it.
I didn't even know.
Yeah.
You know, because, you know, once they left, we put them on a helicopter.
Yeah, it's the last you heard.
I mean, you don't know if they're alive or dead. They never hear from them. So it's tough.
Did you ride home?
I rode home when I could, you know.
I could not tell my mother what was going on over there because it would have killed her.
Yeah, I know.
I just said, you know, like, you know what it was for us for a typical day? That's all I called it. You remember when we came home? The welcome home we got?
I don't know. I mean, I had problems adjusting when I came back.
Yeah, so did I.
I kissed the ground when I got home, when I got in.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I come home, and I walk in the door, and my dad was totally unaware that I was even coming home. And I walked in, and he gave me this big hug. In my entire life, he never hugged me like that. And I said, you know, for every rotten thing you ever did to me, you paid for it that day.
I mean, I was really happy to be back after seeing all the stuff we went through. I'm glad we made it through that experience together.
Yeah.
And after all these years, meeting each other again.
That was James Blankenheim of Madison, Wisconsin, and Everett Wood of Vincennes, Indiana. They shared their experience as part of StoryCorps' Military Voices Initiative, which is made possible by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Want to make sure you catch every Wisconsin Life story? Subscribe to our podcast. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Coming up, we take a look at plans to overhaul the long-criticized U.S. organ transplant system. That's next here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The U.S. government has announced plans to overhaul the U.S. organ transplant system after years of criticism. 22 people die every day, it's estimated, in the U.S. waiting for kidney transplants, with poor and non-white patients disproportionately affected. The U.S. also has a higher rate of wasted donated organs compared to European countries. The overhaul plan focuses on breaking up the, in effect, monopoly that one organization, the United Network for Organ Sharing, has on the system. Lenny Bernstein is a reporter for The Washington Post. He covers health and medicine. Lenny, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Reading your piece on this, Lenny, I realize how little I know about how organ transplant works in the United States. Under the law, there's this one group, this United Network for Organ Sharing, a UNOS, that does everything. Tell us about this organization.
Yeah, it really is sort of remarkable that one nonprofit agency has held the contract to run the entire organ transplant system for 37 years, and especially as that system has grown across the country from, you know, a little small system that involved, you know, several hospitals and organ banks to a nationwide system. There's now 250 hospitals that do transplants. There's 56 little nonprofits that pick up the organs. And at the center of it all is UNOS. They coordinate the whole thing. They run the technology, they make the policy, and they do all this with a contract to the federal government.
What have been some of the criticisms in recent years leveled at the way the system works?
Well, there are quite a few, unfortunately. You can look at their technology, which has really not kept up to date. There are a number of surgeons who use other means to find the kidneys that they are waiting for. You can look at the OPOs that they are supposed to ride herd on. Those are the organ procurement organizations. And unfortunately, they also have little monopolies in their regions. Some of them are quite good and are very aggressive about getting organs from people. Some of them are terrible, and they just don't get very many organs at all compared to their populations. UNOS is supposed to be helping them do better, supposed to be holding them to account when they're not picking up the organs that people need. And that really hasn't happened. And then when there's sort of misconduct or malfeasance or complaints, UNOS is supposed to investigate that. And they don't do that very often at all.
And I also mentioned the concern that we end up donated organs, incredibly valuable, potentially life-saving, we end up wasting more of them than European peer countries?
Yeah, when it comes to kidneys, the most recent figure we have is that 21% of the kidneys in this country were not transplanted. 21% of those collected were not transplanted. That's about double the rate you find in other countries, in comparable countries in Europe. Now, I want to hasten to say that the reasons for this are multifactorial, or at least in dispute. The people who put the organs in say that the OPOs do a bad job of transporting them. But others say that the surgeons who are implanting the organs are kind of picky. They want the very best organs because that's how their programs are judged. And so they discard organs that might come from, say, an older person or a person who has some other comorbidities. So you can't lay that entirely at UNOS's door, but certainly they are involved.
So here comes the Biden administration. What kind of changes are they looking for in the system?
There are many, many changes, but the key one that they're going to do is to break up what UNOS does into several contracts. They're going to say, UNOS, here's four or five tasks that you're now in charge of. We're going to bid those out. We're going to see what other ideas are out there for doing your technology, for doing your policy, for doing your accountability, for doing your logistics. And those are hypothetical. I don't know exactly what each contract is going to be for. Mm-hmm. They haven't decided yet. But what they've come to decide is that after 37 years, this one nonprofit has become sort of ossified and set in its ways. And they want to see what the best and the brightest in each of these areas have to offer. The way to do that is to offer the possibility of taking pieces of this contract and see what is proposed to the government.
This all comes from a 1984 law passed by Congress. Can the administration, can the executive branch do this without Congress changing that law?
Another thing that's in dispute, which, you know, is another one of the frustrations of the organ transplant system. UNOS considers the technology that undergirds the whole system to be its own, that it developed it and it owns it. And that in the law that you mentioned, the Organ Transplant Act, it's sort of the agency that was written, it was the agency they had in mind when they wrote that law. And it has to be a nonprofit that's functioning as a quasi-governmental agency, and there are all these restrictions. Well, the position of some people is that that law has to be rewritten by Congress, which, as your listeners know, it's a very difficult thing to get Congress to agree on anything right now. Carol Johnson, the head of the of HRSA, the government agency that oversees UNOS, says she has a legal opinion that gives her the authority to do it if Congress doesn't act. She'd rather that Congress act, but if they don't, she can do it on her own.
And what would that look like, assuming that legal authority there, Lenny, in our last minute? Is it tomorrow we have a new system? Is it we're going to fix the plane while we're flying? What form would that take?
It's the latter. So let's envision they put out these contracts and a bunch of people bid on them. And then they select, you know, let's say four other organizations to work with UNOS or without UNOS. Then they have to figure out a way to knit all these changes into the existing system while it is still functioning. Remember, organ transplant goes on in this country 24/7, 365. It never stops. It never should stop, because when that liver becomes available, it needs to be raced to the place where the recipient needs it. So all this has to be done on the fly, and it's going to be very interesting to see how that works.
Lenny, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Lenny Bernstein, reporter for The Washington Post. He covers health and medicine. He talked to us about plans aimed at overhauling the U.S. organ donation system. If you have an experience with that system as a donor or recipient, love to hear about your experience. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow here on Central Time, new moms in the U.S. face bigger health risks than moms in other developed countries, and things got worse over the last few years. We'll dig into some of the causes and some possible solutions. And it may feel like Americans are pulling apart because of political polarization. I guess makes the case that we can fix things, in part with some structural changes to our political system. That and more, all coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Up next, it's news from NPR and Wisconsin Public Radio. Then we explore the ever-shifting landscape of streaming TV services. The number of new original scripted series reached a record high last year. Already seeing some slowdowns and contractions in 2023. We will find out what that all means for streaming subscribers. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.